Thank you very much for the opportunity to visit Toronto and to talk to you about some of the roles that might be played by nonlinear dynamics in understanding molecular cell biology. Before I get into the meat of the talk, let me give credits where they're due, to first of all to my collaborators at the Budapest University of Technology and Economics. I've been working with Béla Novák, who's a professor there, on these problems for more than 10 years. And two of our postdocs, Attila Csikasnagy and Andrea Ciliberto, who are now, they're not postdocs anymore, they have beginning faculty positions now. And at Virginia Tech, I work closely with Kathy Chen, who's a research scientist there, and I'll talk about some of the experiments that are done in Jill Seibel's laboratory at Virginia Tech. So let me start with a little history that might be interesting to some of my chemist friends here at the University of Toronto. My PhD is in chemical physics from Chicago in 73, and I had always intended to be a quantum mechanic or statistical mechanic, but in the early 70s I got interested in these oscillating chemical reactions that were capturing people's attention. One of these reactions, called the Belousov-Jabotinsky reaction, it's just a reaction from inorganic chemistry. Basically, you can get these chemicals off almost any chemical laboratory and mix them up in solution, and this reaction will oscillate in time. It's an oxidation-reduction reaction. Bromate, the oxidizing agent, and malonic acid is being oxidized to CO2, and there are iron ions in the solution, and during one phase of the reaction, the iron ions are oxidized to the +3 state, and the solution changes from red to blue, and during another phase of the reaction, iron 3 is reduced back to iron 2 and changes from blue back to red. And this reaction will oscillate red and blue, about every 30 seconds for 10 or 20 minutes. It's really pretty spectacular, and for a chemist, quite unusual. And we wanted to understand the mechanism of this reaction and also how to square it with what we knew about chemical kinetics and thermodynamics. Yeast glycolysis is a famous reaction from biology, from cell biology. During glycolysis, a sugar molecule is oxidized to pyruvate. The oxidizing agent is NAD. This is a disproportionation reaction, so that during the oxidation phase, NAD is oxidized to, or reduced to NADH, and then oxidized back to NAD, and you can see that as a fluorescence signal. And so the fluorescence from NADH will also oscillate in time with a period of about 1 minute. So this is a real challenge to biochemists and to physical chemists, as I said, to understand the general principles of chemical kinetics and thermodynamics that underlies these oscillations, and also the specific mechanisms of these oscillations. This is just a very gross overview of what's going on. One has to look at the detailed mechanism and try to understand exactly what generates the oscillation. So a lot of very important work was done in the early 70s in understanding both of these reactions. I was a little late getting into this because I was just a graduate student at the time. Most of the interesting and fun stuff was done by the big wheels in the field. But it kind of set me up for what I want to talk to you about today. I want to draw your attention to a curious paper that was published by Otto Roessler at about this time, 1972, in the Zeitschrift für Naturforschung. The title of this paper, translated here, Basic Circuits of Fluid Automata and Relaxation Systems. I read this paper also as a graduate student, and it's a curious paper. Roessler looked at a number of little chemical reaction schemes. The A's and B's are chemicals, the arrows are chemical reactions, and he wrote down some simple rate laws for these chemical reactors, and he showed that they function like little elements in electrical networks, like little switches and oscillators and those sorts of components that an electrical engineer would recognize. And then in the conclusion of the paper, he has this sentence. In this manner, the class of chemical switching networks will be promising candidates for a possible new technology of chemical reaction systems. And I think what Russell had in mind, and certainly what other people had in mind at the time and said explicitly, was maybe we would be able to produce a kind of soluble chemical computer that you could mix chemicals together in the test tube and get them to carry out a computation. Because after all, there are switches and oscillators, and that's what a computer is made out of. So maybe we could make a chemical computer. Well, I mean, even at my young and tender age, at that time, that seemed to me like a flaky idea, because a chemical computer is never going to be able to compete with a silicon-based computer, okay? They're already pretty good, and you're not going to out-compute this little laptop or the IBM whatever in the 1970s. So there didn't seem to be any future in that as far as chemistry was concerned. But it didn't take me long to catch on to the fact, under the influence of Stuart Kaufman and Arthur Winfrey, who were at Chicago at the time, that although there wasn't much future in this as a chemist, we actually did have an example of a chemical computer. And that example of the chemical computer is the living cell. The living cell is essentially a bag full of chemicals, genes and proteins and metabolites, which are reacting with each other according to similar sorts of laws, and carrying out all kinds of interesting computations that control the physiology of the cell. And that's the place to apply these ideas about chemical oscillators and chemical switches. So here's a kind of rough cartoon version of part of the cell's computer. This is that part of the cell's computer which gathers information from the outside of the cell. So this lavender thing here is the cell membrane. There are receptors embedded in the membrane that are receiving signals from outside the cell. And those signals are processed by these chemical pathways. They're complicated chemical pathways that communicate with each other. And some sort of decisions are made and executed in terms of changes in gene expression, changes in cell proliferation, that is, cell growth and division, and decisions about cell death, programmed cell death, so cells can commit suicide. So this little information processing system is gathering information, making a decision, and then implementing that decision in terms of these outputs. So it's a signal response system, and one would like to understand what kind of information processing is going on in this network. One reason we'd like to understand it is because this is actually the problems here are the problems that generate cancer cells. So the transformation of a normal cell to a cancer cell are problems somewhere in this information processing system. So if we want to have a scientific understanding of the genesis of cancer cells, we really have to understand this control system from an engineering point of view. Now, we can't answer that question yet. We don't understand this control system. It's actually not very well specified in this cartoon. I want to open this box called the cell proliferation or the cell cycle box and show you in a little more detail the sort of information we have about one of these molecular regulatory networks. So the events of the cell cycle, which is DNA synthesis and mitosis and cell division. It's the way cells replicate themselves and create two cells out of one cell. That's the cell cycle. The events of the cell cycle are controlled by proteins called cyclin-dependent kinases, which in this cartoon are represented by this icon. It has two parts. The gray square in the background is what's called the kinase subunit of the enzyme. A kinase is a protein that can phosphorylate other proteins. That means it adds a phosphate group to a protein. A phosphate group, if you remember your chemistry, carries a lot of negative charge. So when a protein gets phosphorylated, those negative charges force the protein to change its shape, and as proteins change their shape, they change their activity. So these cyclin-dependent kinases phosphorylate target proteins and change their activity. They either turn them on or turn them off, activate them or inactivate them. And that's the way the cyclin-dependent kinases give the commands for the events of the cell cycle. If you want to understand when those commands are given, you have to understand the molecular mechanism that regulates the activity of the cyclin-dependent kinases. Now, as their name suggests, The kinases depend upon a cyclin partner, which is the yellow oval, so they have to form this dimer. Two separate proteins have to hook together in order to have the activity. There are three classes of cyclin-dependent kinases, A, B, and E. They control different events of the cell cycle. And their activity, in turn, is controlled by this complicated mishmash of chemical reactions. Every solid arrow in the diagram represents a chemical transformation. So this is the synthesis of cyclin B to form the dimers. This is the degradation of cyclin B to destroy the dimers. This is the phosphorylation of the kinase subunit to inactivate the molecule. And this reaction is the dephosphorylation, taking the phosphate group off to activate the molecule. Okay? So these are chemical reactions that are transforming one protein into another form of the protein and controlling the activity. The dashed arrows represent catalytic activities. Remember I said that this is a kinase that can phosphorylate other proteins, and one of the proteins that it phosphorylates is CDC25. So CDC25 gets phosphorylated and activated, and then CDC25 takes that phosphate group off and activates cyclin B. So you can begin to see that there are complicated feedback signals in this network. Okay? Now, I know you're not used to thinking along these lines, so you're welcome to interrupt me early on with questions about exactly what's going on here, so we at least get the basic biochemistry to begin with. Pretty soon I'm going to convert these into mathematical equations and you'll feel more comfortable. Okay? So it's a complicated network of interacting proteins. They're binding with each other, they're phosphorylating each other, they're being synthesized and degraded, and it's those chemical reactions that are controlling the time-dependent changes in these master regulators. And we want to understand the dynamics of this control system. You can think of it like it's the wiring diagram of some sort of an electrical device, like a VCR, right? And then these would be transistors and capacitors and resistors and things like that. They're hooked together by wires, and there are flows along those wires that are governed by Kirchhoff's laws. And so you would convert the wiring diagram into a set of differential equations with Kirchhoff's laws. We're going to do something like that for this network. How do they know all this stuff? This is a hypothesis. It's guessed on the basis of genetic experiments that define the genes that stand behind all these proteins. Okay? So this is a hypothesis, okay? There's nowhere you can write away for the wiring diagram of a cell. Like you can write to Sony to get the wiring diagram of your VCR. Okay. Now, if you wanted to understand the dynamics of the VCR, you probably wouldn't be wise to try to write down the full set of Kirchhoff's laws for that big network. You would first want to take a course in basic electrical engineering, and you would break down wiring diagrams into simple little components, which are oscillators and switches, and understand their dynamics, and then start building up something complicated from something simple. And I want to show you that we can do... I'm getting ahead of the subject. Suppose we could. we could. This is Kirchhoff's laws for that chemical reactor system. So for each... for each icon, it's a chemical species. It has some reaction arrows that are coming in and some reaction arrows that are coming out. So we can write a differential equation for the time rate of change of that chemical species. It's got positive terms representing synthesis, negative terms representing degradation. It might bind with molecules and be taken away to some complex. The complex can fall apart. So every chemical reaction gets a representation in these rate laws. And so you can write down a full set of differential equations that describe that network. In those differential equations are these rate constants, K1, K2, K3. That's like the resistance of a resistor or the capacitance of a capacitor. You have to have a numerical value for that, and then you can solve these differential equations, and it will tell you how all the different chemicals come and go. Suppose we knew those numbers, we could just do a brute force simulation of those differential equations and follow the time dependence of all the different species in the network and associate the comings and goings of the different proteins with various events of the cell cycle. But I'm not going to spend any time here. I want to go back to the network and break it apart into smaller pieces. I'll come back to this later. Really, you can't make much sense out of this just by brute force. The calculation is just as complicated as the cell. If you want to understand it, we're going to have to break this network down and see what its pieces are doing. So come back to the network, and let's look at some of the things that are happening in this wiring diagram. This arrow represents the synthesis of cyclin B protein. That synthesis is controlled by another protein called a transcription factor. This particular transcription factor controls how this protein is created from the gene that has the information. This transcription factor can be switched back and forth between an active form and an inactive form, and this dashed line says that the cyclin-dependent kinase can phosphorylate its own transcription factor and activate that transcription factor, which then produces more cyclin D. So that's a little positive feedback loop for the synthesis of cyclin D. It's buried in this network. Down in this corner, we have cyclin A. This is the synthesis of cyclin A. It's controlled by a transcription factor for cyclin A. But the activity of the enzyme, follow this area, phosphorylates and inactivates the transcription factor, so it turns off its own synthesis. So that's a little negative feedback loop. You with me? Well, it is, because the same transcription factor controls the synthesis of cyclin E and the synthesis of cyclin A. So I just called it TFE. I had to make a decision. Okay. Sure.
How do you get something in the denominator
Those are classic rate laws for enzyme-catalyzed reactions. That's where those strange rate laws came from. That's called a Michaelis-Menten rate law. Every biochemistry textbook describes where that comes from. But I don't want to get into those sorts of details, if that's okay with you. Let's look at this part of the mechanism. This red molecule called CKI, that stands for cyclin-dependent kinase inhibitor, it's a protein which can bind to, here's the cyclin-dependent kinase plus its cyclin partner, that's the active enzyme. When it binds to the red protein, it forms a trimer, and that's an inactive complex. So the purpose of the kinase inhibitor is to inhibit the kinase. Makes sense. The active form of the kinase can phosphorylate the kinase inhibitor, and when the kinase inhibitor gets phosphorylated, it gets rapidly degraded. It's just a fact of life. The stability of the kinase inhibitor is controlled by its phosphorylation, so it can be phosphorylated by the kinase and degraded. So these two proteins are mutual antagonists. The kinase inhibitor is trying to block out the kinase activity. The kinase activity is trying to phosphorylate and destroy the inhibitor. So that's a feedback loop based on mutual antagonism between two different proteins. What can that do? Well, it must do something interesting. And up in this corner, we have something similar. WEE1 is a kinase that phosphorylates this kinase and inactivates it. But the cyclin B-dependent kinase phosphorylates WEE1 and inactivates WEE1. So those are two enzymes that fight against each other. They phosphorylate and inactivate each other. So again, it's a mutual antagonism, whereas CDC25 takes that phosphate group off and activates the kinase, and the active kinase then phosphorylates CDC25 and activates CDC25. So that's a positive feedback loop. Okay? But these feedback signals are built into the chemistry. Okay? You with me? Now, don't worry so much about all the complicated chemistry. The chemistry is just a way to build the control system. Just like we build control systems out of silicone and conductors, and we use electrons. That's how we build our control systems, and we use Kirchhoff's laws to describe them. The cell builds its control systems out of genes and proteins and these sort of reactions and feedback signals. But the dynamics of the two systems are going to share some similarities, and it's the dynamics that we want to concentrate on. Okay? You with me? So I'll call these network motifs, and I want to start by looking at some of these simple motifs, and then I will assemble them into more and more complicated control systems. So let's start with the very simplest motif, which is the synthesis of a protein R controlled by a second protein S, which one would call a transcription factor. Remember, transcription factors control the expression of genes to make a protein. For this simple, our variable is R, and the differential equation, the RdT, is plus K1S for the rate of synthesis minus K2R for the rate of degradation. The rate of degradation depends upon how much R you have, so I'll just assume simple linear degradation of the protein. Now, this is a trivial differential equation to solve. You can solve it exactly, but I don't want to solve it exactly. I want to use a graphical approach. The steady state solutions of this differential equation happen where the rate of synthesis is balanced by the rate of degradation. The rate of synthesis is a constant, the rate of degradation is a linear function of R, and where they cross is the steady state, and clearly as you increase the signal strength, you increase the steady state concentration of the response protein R. And if I plot the steady state concentration of the response protein R as a function of the input signal, I just get a linear relationship. Okay, that's absolutely trivial. I'll call this a signal response curve, and now I want to do more complicated signal response curves. Okay, but I'll do it in exactly the same way. So that network is full of this sort of a regulatory system where a protein gets phosphorylated by an enzyme called a kinase, and it gets dephosphorylated by another enzyme called a phosphatase. Two different chemical reactions, and the steady state of this reaction will, you'll find the steady state by balancing the rate of the phosphorylation reaction against the rate of the dephosphorylation reaction, which is what I do in this diagram. I won't go into the details, but the black line is the rate of dephosphorylation, and the dashed line is the rate of phosphorylation. That depends upon how much kinase activity we have. So this is the signal. The kinase is the signal. The phosphorylated form of the protein is the response, and the steady states are where the curves intersect. And now if I plot the steady state response as a function of the signal, I get something more interesting. It's not a linear response anymore. It's a sigmoidal response, an abrupt response. When the kinase activity is small, there's essentially no phosphorylation. When the kinase activity is high, there's a lot of phosphorylation, and there's this steep change in between. I'll call this a buzzer because this is the way the door buzzer works, right? If you push on it a little bit, it doesn't buzz. You have to push on it past the threshold, and then it buzzes, and when you let off, it stops buzzing at the same place. Okay? And if you're a wise guy, you can kind of half depress the buzzer, and it'll go, right? It'll just give you half of a buzz, but it's very, very sensitive there in the middle. Okay, that's a buzzer. And it comes from this simple biochemistry. Now, I want to put those two components together. So the top part is my linear signal response curve. S is driving the synthesis of R. And the bottom part is a buzzer. Now R is phosphorylating E. And the phosphorylated form of E feeds back and drives additional synthesis of R. So it's those two components put together. The linear signal response and the buzzer, I hook them together, and now I get something completely new. Oh, I screwed up the slideshow, didn't I? Well, the rate of synthesis is the dashed curve. It now has this sigmoidal shape because of the buzzer, because you're activating this enzyme E. whereas the degradation is still the straight line, and now we can get three steady state solutions to this system. So the system is bistable. It can have two stable states separated by an unstable steady state. So if we plot the signal response curve, we find for small signals, there are two stable steady states. One stable steady state with low response, and the other state with a high response, and they're separated by an unstable saddle point in between. Okay, and it's natural to call this a fuse, because this is the way a classical electrical fuse works, where this is the current, and this is the state of the circuit. The circuit is closed when the current is small, but if the current gets too high, then the circuit opens, and the current goes to zero, but the fuse stays blown. Okay, so this is a one-way, abrupt switch that flips from the closed state to the open state, or from the off state to the on state, and then stays stuck in the other state. Okay? Comes from this simple kind of biochemistry. You with me?
So these are independent of reaction rates.
You have to choose the reaction rates correctly to get this, but it's very robust. Once you're in the right region of parameter space, this kind of behavior is very robust. So you can twiddle the parameters around, and this will stick, right? These are robust bifurcations. This is a saddle node bifurcation. Okay. Now I'll put two buzzers together. So the response protein R can get phosphorylated and inactivated. The active form of R can phosphorylate E. The phosphorylated form of E can take that inactivating phosphate off and activate R. So these are two buzzers hooked together so that they activate each other. We already saw that in our control system. And now, if you plot the rates of these reactions, the two enzymes, this is a phase plane system for these two buzzers hooked together, again, you can get bistability, two stable steady states separated by an unstable steady state, and now the signal response curve for this system shows two saddle node bifurcations, a region of bistability for intermediate signal strength. And we call this a toggle switch because you can switch this... Whoops, what happened here? You can switch this system between the two steady states. You increase the signal and you'll go from off to on. You decrease the signal and you'll go from on to off. Okay. Now, this is exactly the setup for the cyclin B-dependent kinase. And I want to describe some experiments that can be done in frog eggs. So you induce a frog to lay a bunch of eggs, you put them in a test tube, you squash them, and you isolate the cytoplasm, and you can put in a test tube exactly these reactions. And by properly manipulating that extract, you can control these reactions and do the bifurcation diagram for this particular control system. So remember, this MPF, it gets phosphorylated by WEE1, and that inactivates it. It gets dephosphorylated by CDC25, and that activates it. And the active form of MPF activates CDC25. So this is exactly the setup. The signal strength is the total amount of MPF in the active plus the inactive forms. That's called the total cyclin. And this is the bifurcation diagram that we expect. When the MPF activity is low, the cell is doing DNA synthesis, and when the MPF activity is high, the cell is in mitosis, and it's separating the replicated chromosomes. So you can actually do this experiment in the frog egg extract. You can manipulate the total cyclin in the system, and as you add more and more cyclin to the system, you don't get any MPF activity. The MPF activity is essentially zero, background level. And the nuclei tell you that the cell is in interphase. This is what an interphase nucleus looks like. It's doing DNA synthesis, but it's not in mitosis. In order to go into mitosis, you have to put enough cyclin into the mix to generate a lot of MPF activity, and then nuclei look like that. That's a mitotic nucleus, and this is a nucleus that's not in mitosis. Okay? So very easily, in this experimental preparation, you can manipulate the bifurcation parameter, and you can drive yourself past that saddle node bifurcation and get the control system to switch on, and you see it in the state of the nuclei in the preparation. Now, the prediction of the model is that if we come back down in the other direction, then the system will stay in the on state. The MPF activity will drop, but the nuclei will stay in mitosis until we get to a different threshold when it'll switch off. So here's the second half of the experiment, where we start in mitosis and we decrease the cyclin concentration. Now, as we decrease the cyclin concentration, the MPF activity comes down as it should, but the nuclei stay in mitosis until we get to that threshold, and then they switch from mitosis back to interphase. So in particular, for these values of the bifurcation parameter, the total cyclin in the frog extract, the control system can either be stably in the interphase state, and the nuclei look like that, or stably in the metaphase state, and the nuclei look like that. So this is exactly the hallmark of a bistable system. This is experimental proof of the bistability in this little part of the control system. You with me? Okay, it's important to do this. Otherwise, it's just, you know, kind of theorizing, and the molecular biologists and the cell biologists aren't necessarily going to agree with you, aren't going to believe you. Probably they won't believe you. You have to hit them over the head with a very clear experiment to show that the prediction of the differential equations can actually be verified in a preparation that they're very familiar with. And this is something surprising. It's something that they never thought of doing before we made the theoretical prediction. As a matter of fact, there are two other predictions that come along with this one that I'm not going to describe, also counterintuitive predictions that can be verified in this frog egg extract. Okay. Pardon me?
So the nuclei actually come back together?
Sure. This is the whole point of the cell cycle. And I'm going to do that right now. It's actually an oscillatory process. So the nuclei are going to be in interphase for a while, and they do DNA synthesis, and then they go into mitosis, and they separate the replicated copies of the DNA, and then they go back into interphase, and they replicate the DNA again. So actually, the way you want this thing to work is to go around the cycle and switch back and forth between these two different states. And that's what I want to describe now. The way this happens in the intact frog egg is there's continual cyclin synthesis and cyclin degradation. Cyclin synthesis occurs at a constant rate, but cyclin degradation is regulated by that control system. And there's the component in the control system called the APC, which drives cyclin degradation and is itself activated by MPF. So, when we're in the low state, with low MPF activity, the APC is off and there's little cyclin degradation. So cyclin increases and we move in this direction. But eventually we pass the threshold and we switch to the on state, and now we have a lot of MPF activity. The cell goes into mitosis, but that activates the APC and that degrades the cyclin. So that drives us in this direction until we get past this threshold, and then the system switches off. And then cyclin degradation switches off and we can start over again. So there's in the frog egg, there's this limit cycle oscillation that runs around this loop around the toggle switch and drives the frog egg through repeated rounds of DNA synthesis and mitosis. That's the job of a newly fertilized egg. You with me in the back? Circadian rhythm is very much like this. It's a different mechanism, but can be described by exactly the same kind of reasoning. Question behind? Mm-hmm. In an in an embryo, there's no growth. It's a very big egg, and it divides into smaller and smaller pieces. So it's a special case of the cell cycle. And this control system that regulates MPF activity is running exactly like I described. So there's no growth. The systems are the cells are dividing up and getting smaller and smaller. The total amount of the cyclin dependent of the kinase subunit is constant. The cyclin subunit comes and goes by this synthesis and degradation. Okay, the signal response curve for this more complicated control system has got hop bifurcation. So here's the steady state. Stable steady state loses stability, and oscillatory solutions are generated by a subcritical hop bifurcation. And here are the stable limit cycles for intermediate values of the rate of cyclin synthesis. And then if you make the cyclin too fast, you go back to a stable steady state with lots of MPF activity. That's the signal response curve. You know it as a bifurcation diagram. Yeah, you would. That's going to be hard to see. I'll show you what you can see with a very difficult experiment. This was published just recently in Cell, a beautiful experiment by Pomeranian and Jim Ferrell's lab at Stanford University, very carefully measuring each one of these dots as a separate measurement, the total amount of cyclin in the extract as you go through one cycle. So here's the cyclin slowly accumulating until you go into mitosis, and then the cyclin is rapidly degraded. When the APC turns on, the cyclin is rapidly degraded, and then the next cycle will repeat it. Meanwhile, the MPF activity is the red curve. As the cyclin increases, the MPF activity doesn't. It stays low until at the end of the cycle, then the MPF activates, drives the cell into mitosis, and then out of mitosis. If you plot these two curves in the phase plane, the signal response diagram, you just see the system running around that limit cycle, around the toggle switch, right? Here's the lower branch of the toggle switch. There's the upper branch of the toggle switch. There's the up jump, and there's the down jump. Okay? Exactly as the theory describes, you can see that experimentally in these frog extracts. Furthermore, Pomeranian, Kim, and Ferrell went further and made a new prediction from the differential equations. Remember, that control system has both a positive feedback and a negative feedback in it. And if you knock out the positive feedback in the control system and you just have the negative feedback loop, the system can still oscillate, but the oscillations become faster and smaller amplitude and perhaps a damped oscillation. So this is a conclusion from the underlying differential equations. And you can do that experiment by a very simple genetic manipulation, which I won't explain. But here's their experiment with the positive feedback in place, and here's three cycles of MPF activity with large amplitude and a certain characteristic period. Then genetically, they knock out the positive feedback loop from the system, and they still get oscillations, but now the oscillations are more rapid. There are four oscillations in place of three, and they're of smaller amplitude, and they may even be damping out. So again, it's an experimental verification of an unusual prediction that comes from the differential equations that the molecular biologists never would have put forward from their hand-waving arguments. Okay, you with me? Okay, I want to come back to the full diagram now and talk about some of the consequences of how these different motifs interact with each other in the full cell cycle in yeast cells. I'm going to stick to yeast cells. So remember, now we have little motifs here that represent switches and oscillators, and they're all hooked together and interacting with each other through these cyclin-dependent kinases. So we can expect the bifurcation diagrams are going to be quite complicated. So this is looking more like a VCR, right? And less like a simple motif. Okay. I want to restrict my attention to fission yeast, and in fission yeast you can do a genetic trick and you can get rid of the bottom part of the diagram, which just makes things simpler. Now look, this part of the diagram is based on mutual antagonism. The proteins are mutual antagonists, and they generate a bistable system. And that bistability is easily represented on a bifurcation diagram, where I plot the activity of the cyclin B-dependent kinase as a function of a bifurcation parameter. And the bifurcation parameter I'm going to use is the mass-to-DNA ratio, which is controlling the rate of the effective rate of synthesis of cyclin B. And for intermediate values of the mass-to-DNA ratio, that part of the control system has two stable steady states. A steady state with very low kinase activity, that's the G1 phase of the cell cycle before DNA synthesis, and a state with very high kinase activity, that's the M phase of the cell cycle when the cells are dividing. This part of the control system up here is also generates bistability, but now the lower steady state has an intermediate level of the kinase activity. See, this is 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 4 down here, very low. This is 10 to the minus 1. It's enough kinase activity to do DNA synthesis, but not enough activity to do mitosis. So you can read the physiological state of the cell from the colors on the diagram. The red, very low steady state is G1 phase before DNA synthesis. The yellow steady state means they're either doing DNA synthesis or they're finished with DNA synthesis, so they're automatically in what's called the G2 phase of the cell cycle. And the uppermost steady state is the very high activity. Then the cells are in mitosis and they're separating the DNA. Finally, in this corner, we have the negative feedback loop where cyclin B activates the APC and then the APC degrades cyclin B, and that negative feedback loop generates spontaneous oscillations via a Hopf bifurcation. Okay, so the different parts of the control system are two switches and an oscillator. Two switches and an oscillator. One switch controls getting out of G1 phase, the other switch controls getting out of SG2 phase, and the oscillator controls what happens when the cells go into mitosis. You put two switches and an oscillator together and you get the cell cycle of a fission yeast cell. So this is the bifurcation diagram for all the pieces put together. It's more complicated than any of the individual pieces. There are more bifurcations going on here because the switches and the oscillators are starting to interact with each other. But you can see there's a low stable steady state, that's G1 phase of the cell cycle. There's the intermediate stable steady state, the cells are in S or G2. And then there's the high steady state, which is unstable, and it's surrounded by stable limit cycle oscillations. And those stable limit cycle oscillations are not connected to the Hopf bifurcation. Here's the Hopf bifurcation down here. But the limit cycles have been intercepted by this steady state, and the limit cycles now are created at a heteroclinic bifurcation called a SNC bifurcation. And I just want to explain this to you quickly because it plays such an important role in the story. So here's a SNC bifurcation. Suppose we have a node and a saddle, okay? There's a stable node and a saddle point, and we follow the trajectory coming out of the saddle, and it comes around to the node on the other side. So there's an invariant circle made up of these three trajectories and the two steady states. That's an invariant circle. Now, change a parameter in the control system and push the saddle and the node together. Then I get a saddle node on an invariant circle. And then I just increase the parameter a little bit more, and the saddle and the node disappear, and the invariant circle now becomes a bona fide limit cycle. And the period of this limit cycle, when it's first born, is infinite because it had a steady state on it as it was born. Okay, so this is a Hopf bifurcation is one way to make a limit cycle. This is the other way to make a limit cycle. And on a bifurcation diagram, a SNC bifurcation looks like this. Okay. There's the saddle and the node coming together and the large amplitude limit cycles born on the other side and born with infinite period. So that's exactly what's happening on this bifurcation diagram. Now, let's go back to the brute force numerical simulation of the differential equations. here's the mass to nucleus ratio from my computation. That's the bifurcation parameter on the horizontal axis. And the green curve is the active form of MPF, the cyclin B-dependent kinase. That's the ordinate of the bifurcation diagram. So I can just plot that curve parametrically on the bifurcation diagram, and this is what happens as the cell goes through the cell cycle. Here's division. At the end of the cell cycle, the cell divides in two, so the mass to nucleus ratio goes down by a factor of two, and it ends up here, where the only stable attractor of the control system is this intermediate stable steady state, which has enough MPF activity to drive DNA synthesis. So after a short transient, the cell comes to that steady state and it does DNA synthesis, which only takes 10 minutes. And then by definition, when DNA synthesis is over, we're in G2. The cell stays in G2 until it grows large enough to get past this SNP bifurcation. And then it tries to hop onto the limit cycle. So now the MPF activity goes shooting up, drives the cell into mitosis. That activates the APC, which destroys cyclin B. That drives the cell out of mitosis. And as the MPF activity falls, that's the signal for the cell to divide, and we get reset back to here. So the cell cycle is, the events of the cell cycle are driven by mass increase by growth and then the resetting due to division. And the cell moves through various stages of the cell cycle according to this diagram. Okay, now this explains actually a lot of the physiology of fission yeast cells, but I won't go into that because you don't know about the physiology of fission yeast cells anyway. So let's skip over that. And let me show you what happens when we start to mutate the control system and see what changes that gives to the cell cycle. The most famous mutant in fission yeast is the Wee mutant. These are wild-type fission yeast cells. They're about 14 micrometers long when they divide. There's the division plane. These are Wee cells. They're mutant cells. They're about half the size of wild-type cells when they divide. But the point is, they grow and divide perfectly fine. They're just midgets. They're Wee bonny lads and lassies. That's where the name comes from, Edinburgh, Scotland. Okay, so the regulatory system has been changed. The nuts and bolts of growth and division are all in place, but the thermostat has been turned down. Well, the Wee gene controls this protein. When we knock out the Wee gene, we knock out this part of the control system, and we recompute the bifurcation diagram, and it now looks like this. The big yellow nose that used to stick out here retracts because it's the Wee gene is responsible for that nose. And now the limit cycles come down and attach to this saddle node bifurcation. The SNP bifurcation is down here. And now the cell cycle is organized around this SNP bifurcation. And a newborn cell is attracted to the G1 steady state. So they stay in G1 for a long time until they grow large enough to get past that SNP bifurcation. And then they do S phase and go immediately into M phase. And when they come out of M phase, they divide and they go back into G1. And they're about half the size of wild-type cells, and they have a completely different sort of a cell cycle, but it's completely consistent with the bifurcation diagram, which is coming from the underlying molecular mechanism when you interpret the mutant correctly. I'm almost finished. If we knock out the kinase inhibitor, we knock out this part of the control system, and now the bifurcation diagram, the red nose that used to stick out to here, pulls back to here, but the SNP bifurcation is still here, so the deletion of the gene for the kinase inhibitor has no effect on the cell cycle. The cell cycle looks just like wild-type cells when you delete that gene. Okay? That's perfectly true. That's exactly how that gene behaves. It doesn't have a phenotype. It looks like wild-type cells. Now, we knock out both Wee1 and the CKI. So we knock out all this part of the control system. That's a double mutant. And now we recompute the bifurcation diagram, And all of the saddle node bifurcations are pulled down to very small size. And the stable limit cycle pulls down to very small size. And what happens is that these cells divide very rapidly. They divide faster than they grow, and they get smaller and smaller. And they're trying to get down to here where they could finally stabilize at a very small size. But this size is apparently inconsistent with the viability of the yeast cells. And these yeast cells die. When you create the double mutant, that's a lethal combination, and the cells die by dividing themselves to death. They get smaller and smaller and smaller, and they croak. Okay? So again, this complicated phenotype, an unexpected phenotype of this double mutant is completely consistent with the wiring diagram when it's properly interpreted. So, here's my concluding slide. What I've been trying to emphasize is that understanding cell physiology from the underlying wiring diagram of the control system is something like trying to understand a complicated electrical machine from its underlying wiring diagram. And we don't do that by trial and error. Computers and VCRs weren't created by arbitrarily putting pieces together and hope they work. There's an underlying theory, there's an underlying mathematical theory, an understanding of the components which allows you to assemble them into more and more complicated control systems to do something interesting. And the same is true of cells. It's just a whole lot harder because we have to guess the wiring diagram and the constants that go into the differential equation. But ultimately, we understand them in the same way, write down the governing differential equations, and analyze them by bifurcation theory, do numerical calculations so we can compare with experiments and begin to make some sense out of this. Thanks to the funding agencies, the James S. McDonald Foundation and DARPA. And there are some review articles that you might find interesting if you want to follow up on this. And I'm sorry I went a little over.